Blog Talk Radio.
Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, on Monday, June 13th, day number 164 of 2011. And tonight we're going to continue our series of shows, Growing Up Cuban in the United States. And it's always an honor to welcome to our show Carlos Haiti. Of course, Carlos is a professor at Yale, but he's also the author of two books about Cuba, books that many of you have read, Waiting for Snow in Havana, and the very latest book that he just published, Learning to Die in Miami. So let's say hello to Carlos Haiti. How are you, Carlos?
I'm fine, Silvio. How are you?
I'm doing absolutely great. First of all, I should tell you congratulations on the success of your book. It's well-deserved, all the recognition you've been getting.
Thanks. Yeah, it always feels good.
It feels good to finish it and then relax, I guess, a little bit, right?
Yeah, it does feel very good when you put a lot of effort into something and it's appreciated. There's no other feeling in the world that comes close to that. So
maybe winning the World Series or the Super Bowl would be.
Well, in the equivalent of writing and publishing, it's just about that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And there's just about as much luck involved too.
Well, that given the quality of your work, though, I think luck is probably not the reason. But what we're going to do tonight, we had several listeners email some questions to us, and we're going to be going through some of those later on, Carlos. And then we are going to be getting a phone call or two from some other friends of the show to talk about your book. But I thought we would begin, Carlos, as I like to with every guest, even though you are a repeat guest, if you could just give us a little biography about you. You don't have to tell us the whole story of the book, but tell us a little bit about yourself. Obviously, you were born in Cuba and you came here as a youngster, so why don't you tell us a little bit about you?
Yeah, I was born in 1950, late 1950, in Havana. And in 1962, when I was 11, my parents put my brother and I on a commercial flight, sent us to the U.S. unaccompanied. We were part of the so-called Pedro Pan airlift. And my brother and I knocked around from foster home to foster home for 3.5 years in the U.S. without our parents. And then finally in 1965, very late 1965, our mom joined us, and we moved to Chicago. And my father never left Cuba. He never got to leave, so I never saw him again. And then against the advice of every teacher I had and every professor I had, I decided to go for a PhD in late medieval and early modern European history. And that's what I did. And I've been teaching now for 32 years at the college university level in late medieval and early modern history, which has nothing to do with Cuba.
No.
But then I published my first memoir and came out in 2003, which detailed my boyhood in Cuba from birth to the time I left. And now I've published a second memoir, Learning to Die in Miami, which covers that 3.5 year period when my brother and I were here in the U.S. Without our parents.
Yeah, fascinating. Let me ask you a question about Cuba, about what's happening in Cuba right now before we get to the topic of your book. A lot of discussion about what's happening in Cuba right now, even some people suggesting that there are some changes in Cuba. I mean, capitalism, the Castro, in this case, Raul Castro, who seems to be, sending out some signals about capitalism. I don't believe it, but how do you feel about it?
No, I don't believe it for a minute either. And besides, they've tried this before. They set up a sort of similar model in the early 90s after the Soviet Union pulled out, after the Soviet Union collapsed and there was no more Soviet Union. They tried it, and this is just a you know, basically an attempt to regulate and tax the sort of black market economy, which has always been a part of the Cuban system. So we'll see. It remains to be seen how much of this is a real opening. What I do hear from a few people I know that lived through Eastern European communism, just about all of them have told me that these are the cracks. These are the final cracks.
Mm-hmm.
What they saw in the late 80s in Eastern Europe, and that you know, the two leaders are getting old. None of the leadership is beyond their age group in terms of youth, and these are desperate measures.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a domino effect, as many of my Eastern European friends have said to me. It's a domino effect that once it begins, it's sort of irreversible. So that's what gives me hope.
Mm-hmm.
Not that these are real reforms, but that these so-called reforms are a last-ditch attempt to fix something that's horribly broken.
Yes. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and we're talking to Dr. Carlos Eide, professor at Yale and the author of two books, Waiting for Snow in Havana, a wonderful book, and the new one, Learning to Die in Miami, and that's the one that was just published here in the last, I guess November is when it came out, right?
November,
Carlos?
Yeah.
November, yeah.
And
November,
the paperback just came out June 6th. So.
Wow. That's great. And were these books, I never asked you this before, but were the books ever translated into Spanish?
That's an interesting story. the short answer is yes. The first one was translated into Spanish, but it's only available in the United States, Canada, and Puerto Rico. Not a single Spanish-speaking Latin American country or Spain itself have wanted to publish the book. It's been turned down by every publishing house.
Hmm. You know, that's interesting.
And the same is true of the second one. It's available in the U.S., Canada, and Puerto Rico.
Wow.
But not anywhere else.
That's interesting, because I had Humberto Fontova, with you one time, and, you know, I've had him several times on the show over the last 3 or 4 years. He also had a lot of troubles getting his books translated into Spanish. He suspected maybe a little political correctness there on the part of some of our Latin American friends, you know?
It's definitely true. Waiting for Snow in Havana has been translated into 13 languages.
Oh, wow.
It's available in, you know, actually I have two Portuguese translations, one for Brazil and one for Portugal, but nothing in the Spanish-speaking world. Nothing.
Wow.
Zero.
That's fascinating. Maybe it'll be translated in a free Cuba. Wouldn't that be a treat?
That would be a treat. I know of people who have smuggled it in,
mm-hmm.
Because it's banned, and you know, anyone caught with it could get into trouble, supposedly. But I've already talked to and met several people who have smuggled in copies, but I have yet to hear from a single reader in Cuba. Of course, you know, how are they going to communicate with me?
Well, the only way they could, I guess, would be through somebody who goes to Cuba, you
right.
know? That would be the only way, because I had that happen to me one time, I guess about 20 years ago. I did some broadcasts on La Voz de la Fundación, which was the Cuban-American National Foundation shortwave station.
Mm-hmm.
And I was doing some, like, commentaries. And I did get some confirmation that people were hearing it through a couple of friends who went down. So they just don't have, you know, this is a hard concept, I think, for a lot of Americans and a lot of people to understand. They just don't have the same freedoms we have. We take a lot of this stuff for granted, and we think that people, you know, talk freely all the time. Well, it's not true in a repressive government like that.
No, I have one uncle who still lives in Havana, and poor guy, he keeps sending me emails through friends that he has
mm-hmm.
in the ministry of this or that. I mean, you know, the few people who have access to emails. And for the past 2.5 years or so, I've replied to every one of those emails with different email addresses, and none of them, my messages have gotten to them.
Wow.
Not one.
Yeah.
It's truly amazing.
Yeah, I don't know of a single, I don't know of any relative of ours that has email. And, whenever we've contacted them, it's always been through letters or through messages of people who've gone through Mexico.
Right.
I remember when my wife's brother, my wife is from Mexico City, when her brother went to Cuba back in the late 1990s, I gave him my cousin's phone number and contact information, so they got together. And so that way we were able to at least establish some communication. But it is very hard to speak to them with any kind of with any of the modern technology that we take so much for granted here.
I know. It's
Carlos, it's really amazing.
Like pre-industrial age, basically.
Well, it really is. And not only does it hurt in the sense that it keeps families away, but it hurts them even from the standpoint of doing business. And I'll just give you an example. When I was in Mexico, and this would have been the late 1980s, I was down there on a business trip, and I was talking to a Mexican businessman. And we started talking about Cuba, and he mentioned he was doing some business in Cuba. And he was complaining that the company in Cuba did not have a fax machine because,
right.
and I'm sitting there saying, they couldn't do business. They couldn't contact because the phones were so bad and the fax machines were totally unreliable. Well, let's talk a little bit about this topic of growing up Cuba, because when I read your books, and I'm sure that when you are around the country doing your book tours, I bet a lot of people react the way I do, which is that we're reading a little bit of ourselves in your story. Obviously, everybody has a different story. Yours is more dramatic than mine, because I came here with my mom, my dad, my younger brother, and my younger sister. So we came as a family, and whatever adversity I faced with a family. Obviously, you came by yourself. But when I read your books, I notice that something that happened to you that happened to me as well. And that is, you come here, I was 12 when I came, you come here and you're 100% Cuban because that's all you are. And then, in our case, living up in Wisconsin, where there was no Cubans to speak of, you, in essence, you go being 100% Cuban to almost being zero Cuban, because you have to survive in your new country. And then at some point in your adult life, at some point with me, it was Mariel. That's what was the tipping point when I saw what was happening with Mariel in 1980. At that point, then you start going back to being Cuban, and then you reach this point where we are right now, sort of learning to die in Miami, which is basically you're a Cuban American, and you know you're going to live here for the rest of your life, and you kind of accept everything. That's sort of how what I read in your books, and it's very similar to my story and that of lots of other Cubans that I've talked to, Carlos.
Yeah, well, my tipping point was much later than yours. For me, it was Elian Gonzalez in late 1999, 2000. It took me that long to sort of circle back to my Cuban identity. It's hard when you live outside of the Cuban community. I spent every year of my life since 1963 in places where there weren't very many Cubans, and sometimes in places where I was not just the only Cuban, but the only foreigner, period. So it was hard, but at some point, I came back to it, and the point was a very painful one. Elian Gonzalez, I saw myself in his story. I saw the story of every single Cuban,
mm-hmm.
Sort of compacted into his story. And I know some Cuban Americans who have written to me, or whom I've met at talks. You know, their encounter with my book was their first step towards reclaiming their
mm-hmm.
Cuban heritage. And I assume that, you know, if there are these people for whom just picking up my book is the first step, there are many out there who have not come back and
yeah.
not reclaimed. And that's understandable.
Mm-hmm.
It's a very painful thing. You know, I wouldn't actually recommend it to anyone as a kind of a joyful passage in
mm-hmm.
life. Or a joyful point in life that you can say, oh my God, this is a high point. No, it's a very painful process, because you have
right.
to accept everything that is good along with so much that is not just bad, but actually tragic.
Mm-hmm.
Not just in a personal sense, but a national sense.
Right. No, you're exactly right. I mean, for me, it was Mariel, because when we first came, we lived in Wisconsin, so I had a similar experience to your experience. That is, we were not in Miami. If you're in Miami, it's a totally different. I mean, the Cubans of Miami are totally different than the Cubans elsewhere, because you were growing up in a different culture. And I was up there, and at first, everywhere I went, people would ask me about Cuba. But then after a while, they weren't asking me about Cuba anymore. Then, the 70s passed. And all of a sudden, in 1980, when Mariel occurs, everybody's asking me questions like, well, why do they want to leave your country? What is it about your country? And so that's when I began to think about this. And I said, you know, this is really interesting. Here's a country that where I came from. And now everybody wants to leave. And, of course, you know the story of Mariel, 100,000 people leaving. And that's when it started to really come back to me. And then at that time I said, you know, I need to learn about this. So then I began to sit a lot with my parents. I would talk to my parents a lot. I read a great deal about Cuba. And here's something interesting, Carlos, that happened to me. And probably it happened to a lot of other Cuban Americans. My parents told us a great deal about Cuba when we first came. And when I went out on my own and started to research, everything they said turned out to be true. The prosperity, the situation in Cuba. And it's almost like, you know, everything they said to me, you know, just about everything they said was true about Cuba. And that made me feel good, because I said, you know, this is the country that my parents used to tell me about. I mean, when I did my own research and I would investigate Cuba before Castro and came to the conclusion, you know, it wasn't really that bad of a country. We had problems, but certainly not the image that has been created of our country by the Castro and the left, you know?
Yeah, or even worse than that, if I could back up just a bit, one of the very first things I noticed when I came to the United States was my school textbooks, the geography textbooks and the history textbooks, what they had to say about Cuba in particular and Latin America in general, struck me as being so wrong and so misleading. You know, this caricature of Cuba and all of Latin America as being the same, basically, which is that you have 1-2% of the population owning everything and exploiting everyone else. That picture of pre-Castro Cuba, which Castro exploited, was present here in the United States in school textbooks before Fidel.
That's right.
And it rubbed me the wrong way then, and it kept rubbing me the wrong way. I never, I didn't really have the same experience as you, because I didn't have parents to tell me stories about Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And even when we reunited with our mom, we were all so busy working. You know, it may sound like an exaggeration, but it's not. We didn't have time to spend together. And my brother and I were already, you know, teenagers and on our way to independence. So we didn't stay with our mom. And we went off our own way into American culture, but I never had to have this confirmation. What I did find out after the year 2000, when I started doing a lot of reading on Cuba, was that Cuban history was far, far, far more interesting and complex than I had ever imagined.
Mm-hmm.
And that, in fact, the Cuba I was born into was a very unique place. Very
right.
Unique in so many different respects. And that it was actually a very recent place.
Mm-hmm.
After independence, my father was born in 1909. So he was born 7 years into independence. Right? The Cuba he was born into was not at all like the Cuba I was born into.
Hmm. That's right. Well, I know in my own case, Carlos, my grandmother, she always told us a story. My grandmother was born in 1892, so she was actually born in the Spanish colony.
Right.
She was 10 years old when Cuba became an independent country, and she always told me the stories about all the Cuban flags hanging from the windows. And, of course, then she comes to the United States. So here's a lady that was born in a Spanish colony, then, of course, became a citizen of the República de Cuba, the Republic of Cuba, and then left Cuba and actually died. She's buried here in Dallas. So that's a trajectory.
Wow.
I mean, I don't know how many people have grandmothers with stories like that. What kind of leads me to the next question? I've got a couple of general questions, and I want to get into some of these emails because they're fascinating. But I've always felt that our immigration, our Cuban immigration, is very different from any other that has ever come to the United States. And I feel that I really feel that. You know, and eventually that's going to pass because obviously my sons don't feel that way. But that we were very special. We were very special, and that's why books like yours are so valuable, because I can see people 50, 60, 100 years from now reading your books and learning and just fascinated with Cuban immigrants. Do you feel that way?
Oh, definitely. And, you know, for one thing, even before I started reading about Cuba in the 20th century, before Fidel, I knew that there was something very odd about us as immigrants in the U.S. because we came here, most of us, for political rather than economic reasons. And we came here with a sense of purpose. We were ideological, and in many cases, you know, ideological / religious refugees. We were refugees. We weren't immigrants. We were refugees, most of us.
That's right.
Came in the first many waves until fairly recently. After Mariel, it became immensely difficult to differentiate between political and economic,
mm-hmm.
and ideological, because Cuba was such a wreck that you couldn't separate
right.
one from the other. But what also struck me once I started reading is the fact that Cuba was very unique place in this one way. It was unique for many reasons, but one of them was the fact that Cuba had a huge wave of immigration itself.
Mm-hmm.
Between 1900 and 1930, about 1 million Europeans migrated to Cuba, when the population of the island was only 2 million. So most of us had at least some grandparent or great-grandparents, or in many cases parents, who were themselves immigrants, just like
that's
here
right.
in the U.S.
That's so, exactly right. And I can see it in my own family, Carlos. You know, my grandfather on my mother's side of the family was born in Spain. My mother's sister was married to a Cuban of Lebanese
right.
descent. So you had that all over. You know, it's funny because on Sunday I was at my parents' home with my wife and we were talking, and, you know, my parents were talking about their old hometown, or my mother's hometown, El Ciego de Ávila, and my mother was talking about El Centro Asturiano. And there,
right.
was,
yeah.
there was a Centro Asturiano or
uh-huh.
Centro Gallego,
that's
Centro
right.
Avileño. I mean, there was a centro in just about every part of Cuba,
right.
you know, yeah, honoring our specific Spanish immigrants. One question I wanted to ask you, and I think I asked you this when I learned that you were going to do this book, but the title always struck me as a little different, you know. In fact, when I first heard the title, I was wondering if there was something maybe wrong with you that you were going to die on us or something, you know, because, you know, I said learning to die, but obviously you were thinking differently. But how did you come up with that title? It's
yes.
a fascinating
well,
title.
You know, that has several layers to it, and one of the first and most important layers is a very prominent Cuban trait, and that's exaggeration. You know, I'm going to die
right.
if you force me to do this. Me vas a matar. You're going to kill
right,
me.
Right.
But it's a metaphorical death.
Right.
But it became very clear to me once I was writing the book that the title had to be this and nothing else, because the immigrant experience is a death.
Right.
You die. You know, you lose your former self. You
mm-hmm.
die. You have to become someone else.
That's
so of
right.
Of course, the flip side is that, you know, it's not just death. It's a rebirth. But I put the focus on death rather than rebirth, because it really, in the case of refugees like us, it really is much more of an immediate and very painful process of dying.
Hmm.
And you have to be instantly reborn, but it's, you know, it's not like in the case of most immigrants who think, well, if it doesn't go well there, I can come return home. And for us, there was, especially for us who came as kids, there was no turning back.
Right.
And it was a real death. We lost everything. We lost our parents. We lost all our relatives in most cases.
Mm-hmm.
We lost everything we had grown up with, the culture and everything, and got sent to, you know, way out of the way places like Bloomington, Illinois, or, you know, kids got sent everywhere. We got sent to 40 different states.
Right.
Very, very remote places in some cases.
Right. So, and there were 14,000 of them. I think, you know, that's the amazing figure. You know, when I think of the Pedro Pan, the Peter Pan program, 16,000, right? 14,000 or 16,000. Yeah, 14,000 children. I think it's the largest exodus of children ever in Latin America. And somebody told me that there was a huge exodus during the Spanish Civil War when a lot of children were sent to Latin America from Spain, but I don't know if it was 14,000.
Oh, but no, it's even worse than that in Spain. A lot of kids were sent to the Soviet Union, and they never came back.
Wow.
Which was in the back of the minds of many of our parents who sent us here to the U.S. who had Spanish parents or grandparents. They had a living memory of these kids who were sent to the Soviet Union and never returned.
Wow.
But, you know, the 14,000 is just the tip of the iceberg. And here's the statistic that I think is really chilling and reveals a lot about how bad things were in Cuba. 14,000 of us got out, but when the program ended abruptly in November of 1962 as a result of the missile crisis, you know, Fidel shut the door and he wouldn't let anybody leave, including our parents. Okay, when the door closed in November of 1962, there were 80,000 other children signed up for the program waiting to leave who didn't get to leave.
Wow.
80,000. So if you also add the thousands who came to the U.S. with uncles and aunts, and we don't know exactly how many, hundreds, maybe over 1,000, who went to Spain unaccompanied. We're talking about 100,000 children whose parents were not just willing but eager to send them away, not knowing if they would ever see them again.
Wow. Yeah, it is an amazing story, isn't it?
And it's 100,000 children in an island which at the time only had 6 million people.
Right. That is stunning when you look at it in those terms. It is absolutely stunning. We're talking to Carlos Ader, Dr. Carlos Ader, professor at Yale and the author of two great books, Waiting for Snow in Havana and the new one that just came out, is doing quite well, Learning to Die in Miami. You know, I read some of the book reviews, and then we're going to get into some of these questions from the audience, but I read some of the book reviews, and, you know, book reviews, I'm sure for an author like you, book reviews at times could be a pain in the neck, you know, but I found one that was very interesting by a lady, last name is Johnson. I don't know if you remember this particular one, but it was available on the internet, and she wrote a book, and, I mean, she wrote about your book, and you know, interesting book review, I thought, and I love the last paragraph in which she basically said, you know, throughout the whole book, you know, she was cheering for you and your brother, and as you were meeting all the adversity, such as the passing of your mother and all of that as well. And then she said, at the end, it all worked out because you became a professor and you became a author. So I guess in many ways, Carlos, your life, despite all the adversity, has turned out rather well. Which I think it's the point she was making in the book review. That's more or less, you know, how I felt about that book review. Do you recall that book review?
I didn't see that one. No.
I'll send you that one by email. It was a very interesting book review. It was done by one of the Florida newspapers, and the lady's last name is Johnson, and I read the one in the New York Times. I read the one in a couple of other newspapers, but this is the one that I thought was most interesting of all of them. So I'll email it to you, but and let you look at it because I think you'll enjoy the last paragraph as much as I did. Well, we had some of our listeners submit some questions, and some of them I had an opportunity to email to you. But this one came in after, and this is from Fausta, and Fausta Wirtz, of course, she's a blogger, and we've had.
Yeah, I know Fausta.
Oh, you know Fausta, great.
Yeah.
Well, she says, "Give my best to Carlos, and ask him what he thinks of the reaction to learning to die. You know, what do you think of the reaction? I guess that's the question."
Well, most of it was positive, you know, and most of it expressed a certain amount of puzzlement over the story, because it's something that most reviewers had never heard of before, weren't aware of the Pedro Pan airlift and so on. So a lot of time, a lot of space in the reviews was dedicated to kind of expressing surprise at, you know, what happened and that this was part of the story. And most of them were positive, so I was glad about that. But one review in particular, which appeared in the Washington Post by Jonathan Yardley, who is their chief book reviewer, was just awful.
Hmm.
It was almost psychotic in its approach, basically saying that, you know, I was a whiner and a complainer, and I had nothing to complain about because, you know, talk about this other review you just mentioned. Everything had turned out all right, so what's with all the complaining about what happened? And I didn't see the book as a complaint. I saw it as a kind of a chronicle a history of what had happened to me and my brother, and things didn't turn out so well for my brother.
Hmm.
Just the complete opposite of me in terms of outcome.
Right.
And he was he was crushed by the experience.
Yeah.
So,
and so were other kids.
Don't get it.
Yeah, I mean, there were some other kids too who didn't turn out well for one reason or another. But one thing that amazes me, and then we'll get to another question. One thing that amazes me, when you said that the amount of time that is paid to the whole Pedro Pan story, it still amazes me that 40 years later, given the numbers and the size of this exodus, that a lot of people still don't know about it. I mean, it's just mind-boggling to me that more people don't know about this Pedro Pan, considering the numbers that you were just talking about. It's just mind-boggling.
But it's the fact that we came in like drops from a faucet.
Hmm.
You know, we would come in six or seven per flight, maybe 10 at most. You know, drip, drip, drip every day, just a handful of kids. And as soon as we got to those camps in Florida, they'd sort us out and send us somewhere else. So
right.
We were literally invisible and out of everyone's vision.
Well, the
Except
other
on the
thing,
local level, on the local
yeah, right.
level, you know, places that received these Cuban kids were aware of them.
Right. No,
but
you're right.
It was never on a sort of a national level, and no one ever, no journalist ever, you know, pulled all the facts together and did a story. So, you know, the time came and went, and we all grew up, and that's it, forgotten.
Yeah.
Until some of us started to write about it.
Right, and there were some documentaries that were done about it as well. But I also think another thing that happened to many of us Cubans who came here as kids in the 60s is that, you know, after the missile crisis, I think Cuba, a lot of Americans didn't want to think about Cuba. You know, that's the impression I have. You know, the world, I mean, there was nearly a nuclear war over Cuba. And then the United States went into a period where you had the civil rights movement, you had Vietnam, you had Watergate. It was a period of a lot of other things going on. And I think, you know, our story, as noble as it may have been, it just got lost. There was just too many other things on the front page, because that's sort of what happened to me, you know, that all of a sudden I found that Cuba was like on the side because there were too many other things going on in the country, all those things that I mentioned, and I think maybe that was a part of it. Here's a great question, Carlos. This is from Miguel Angel in Madrid, and I found this question fascinating, so fascinating. I emailed it to you because I wanted you to want to make sure you had a chance to see it. Here follows the question that I would like to put to Carlos Aide. As a Cuban genealogist, I had the chance to read your wonderful book, Waiting for Snow in Havana, and a dozen books of your father. I think he means your uncle.
He's my uncle,
Rafael Nieto Cortadellas. Despite the distance with your Cuban family, I wonder if you know whether your father, meaning your uncle, left any unfinished works on genealogy, and if so, is there any chance of getting them published outside of Cuba? I didn't know about your uncle, but this is a great question.
Yeah, no, Rafael Nieto Cortadellas was one of Cuba's premier genealogists. And no, I don't think he left anything unfinished. He left Cuba in the late 1970s and went to Puerto Rico and lived there for the remaining 10 or 12 years of his life. And all his three children now, in their 70s, live in Puerto Rico. But no, he published everything he wrote. As far as I know, everything that he wrote was published. So there's no unpublished material from my uncle.
Right.
But his nickname was Filo.
Filo, okay. So he was your uncle then.
He's my father's brother.
Your father's brother. Now, your father was a judge in Cuba, right? And he remained in Cuba. What kind of judge was he?
He's a municipal judge.
Okay.
And, you know, throughout my childhood, he was judge of this or that municipality. He was judge of Marianao. He was judge of Guanabacoa, judge of Regla, and one more place. I can't remember.
Almendares? I was thinking of the baseball teams, you know. I figured.
Yeah, those are all like baseball teams. but after I left, I don't know what he did. I have no idea what compromises he had to make for a period there, right after Fidel took over.
And when did your father die?
1976.
Okay, so
he was preparing to leave. He had already retired for health reasons. He had a bad heart, so he had retired for health reasons and was putting everything together so that he could leave. And you know, back 1976, it was pretty long and arduous and time-consuming process.
Right. Interesting.
To leave. And he died before he had a chance to get out. And that was that. But he and he had two brothers and one sister. Two brothers and the sister left. He was there alone. And once he died, that was it for our family there. We didn't leave behind anybody, the entire family, the Nieto family, except for some distant cousins. Everybody left.
And wow.
Left behind.
Yeah.
So,
one more question. This is from Ziva, and Ziva is a contributing writer to Babalu. And I think she met you when you were down in Miami.
Yeah, we met in Miami at
Cuban Nostalgia, where you spoke, and she wanted to ask you a question about she thinks the greatest tragedy of the Castro regime is the separation of the families. Apparently, you and Carlos Franchi had some kind of a common or a seminar or something? And I thought maybe
Carlos Franchi was Fidel's propaganda minister.
Right.
Until 1968 when he was purged.
Right.
When Franchi was purged. And Franchi came to speak here about a year before he died. And I had a chance to sit next to him at dinner. And I asked him, tell me, what did you guys know about the airlift? And why did you let the kids go? It always seemed kind of counterintuitive to me.
Right.
That they allowed us to leave. But he said with a big smile on his face, and he knew I was one of the kids, he said, oh, it was music to our ears. Anything that would destroy the bourgeois family was music to our ears. We were so happy about it. We were thrilled. So they were very, very Machiavellian and cold-hearted about the whole thing, because the minute that the door closed and no more kids could leave, they arrested all the people responsible for the airlift.
Right.
And the three leaders of the Pedro Pan airlift in Cuba, the ones who made it possible for us to leave, all of them spent over 20 years in prison.
Wow.
So they were as cold and calculating as any Nazi ever was.
Yes, that's right.
Human beings were not human beings. They're just figures in there. There are desirables and undesirables.
Yes, that's exactly right.
Do what you have to with the undesirables, and it doesn't matter what's involved. So, y'all, this is what made me half insane or maybe completely insane during the Elian Gonzalez event.
Mm-hmm.
Was that the Cuban government was claiming that the boy needed to be with his father, as if they cared.
Right.
You know, in fact, I knew for a fact that not only they didn't care, they couldn't have cared less about the issue of the boy being with his father. They had actually turned it into a part of their system to break up families. And
that's exactly right.
They sent fathers to slave labor camps and wouldn't allow fathers to leave with their families.
Mm.
For years and years and years, almost any family that wanted to leave was not allowed to leave intact. The father had to go do slave labor.
Amazing. Yeah, I know. That's the story, and that's exactly you described them as Nazis, and that's exactly what they are. Well, we're out of time, Carlos. I want to thank you so much. First of all, congratulations on the success of your book. It's a very inspirational book, and for many of us, I see a lot of ourselves in that book. I just see your experience coming here. It touches a lot of us, and that means it's fun to see that part. But I just want to wish you the very best, and again, thank you for joining us. It's always really, really good to sit down and chat with you, and I just want to tell you, thank you on behalf of many Cuban Americans. Thank you for doing this, because I think you wrote a story that a lot of us, you touched a lot of us.
Well, thank you for your show, and thank you for inviting me to be on the show.
Thank you very much, Carlos.
Great to be here.
All right. We're going to take a little. Thank you very much, Carlos. We're going to take a little break, and we will be right back with a closing commentary. Bye. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, Texas, Monday, June 13th. I had been looking forward to this show for quite some time. Carlos Aide, Dr. Carlos Aide, of Yale, University of Yale, professor at Yale, and the author of these two books. And again, as I mentioned to Carlos, as a Cuban American, I think we relate to this book a great deal. It means a lot more to us, of course, I suppose, than it would mean to another person. But it is a great story, the story of coming to the United States, finding who you are, and eventually at the end, it all comes together, as Carlos was saying. But a great, great story, something that we would definitely recommend the book. The book is doing quite well, of course, and we're very happy that Carlos has written another book, another very successful book. Just a quick note, if you were watching that CNN debate, Bill Katz and I will have a commentary on that debate in our next show. And then, of course, on Thursday, we're going to do our annual Father's Day show. And congratulations to Texas A&M. They have now clinched a position in the Baseball College World Series, and they will be going there as well as Texas, the Texas Longhorns. And last but not least, of course, congratulations to the Dallas Mavericks, who are the NBA, the ABA NBA champions of 2010-2011. Everybody have a good evening, and we will talk the next time. This is Silvio Canto in Dallas, and our thanks again to Carlos Aide. Good night, everybody.
Thank you.